take me home. Country roads, country roads, take me home to the place I belong. West Virginia, Mountain Mama, take me home. Country roads, take me home. Country roads, take me home. Country roads.
And that was John Denver with Country Roads, and we're going to say goodbye to Ear Buddies. And yeah, let's see. Let's get them their CD so they're not waiting. And you're listening to WMFO 91.5 FM, Tufts Freeform. Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio. And we're a little slice of that community base. Social alternative radio, talking music from a working class, democratic socialist perspective. And we're here every other week, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Today, your co-hosts are myself, Jeff, and...
Diego.
And welcome back, Diego. Thanks for taking the trip on the the increasingly dysfunctional bus system here, which I have to ride to sometimes in the MBTA, what we call it here.
The trains are not as fast no more.
Trains are horrible, man.
Especially the Red Line. They're all going slow at a certain stops because of the... We might derail.
Price went up, for those of you not from the Boston area. Yeah, by the way, when you're listening to Social Alternative Radio, keep in mind we have listeners from all over the world, which we're really, really proud of, that we've reached beyond there. We reach beyond there, reach beyond here, sorry. We're reaching out to there, and that's really good. And people write into our Facebook page, Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook. Please do so yourself. We put a lot of content up there as well. If you want to listen to the show, though, we don't have the show archived on our Facebook page. We have it on this WMFO.org website. The last show, previous show, should be archived.
For 2 weeks.
Yeah. And then there was a website called... Fenian Rising.org, F-E-N-I-A-N, Rising.org, and also a Facebook page, Fenian Rising. And they used to, kindly, very nice of them, download our shows and have them available for people. But that that might be changed. I think that changed. I think they didn't have time to deal with that after a while. And so anyway... you can also go to socialistalternative.org for more information about a lot of the stuff we talk about. And also just, write down some of the citations we give. We try to explain where our sources are for things that we're talking about. But also we just sort of, in the talk world, freeform it a bit in terms of talk goes. And we want to start off with what I'm calling their economy and ours, and talk a little bit about that. And then we'll take a break, a musical break. So we are talking in music. And what we mean by their economy and ours is if you live in the United States, you're hearing this is a great economy right now. And as you also hear, even in the corporate media, there's somewhat a little bit of other information, a little bit of, I wouldn't call it actually pushback, but a little bit of, except wages are flat and all that. And that little exception is actually huge. Also, the way the economic statistics are gathered and kept is always stilted. It's always biased towards having a rosier picture than there really is. Like, for example, something I'm familiar with, unemployment statistics are, after a while, they're not kept. If you're not applying if you're not going to the unemployment office, you could be out of work and still not be a statistic in the unemployment rolls. In other words, they call that stopped looking for work or something like that. I don't know what their official phrase is for that. People that have stopped looking for jobs officially through the getting unemployment and checking off, yes, I looked this week, and explaining what that means. They're not counted. Unemployment laws vary, I believe, from state to state. And so some are harsher than others. You might have ever gotten on the rolls to begin with. And then in terms of underemployment, people forced to work part-time jobs, cobbled together two or three part-time jobs. You were doing that not too long ago, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you did that for a long time, right?
Yeah.
Now, I was telling someone about one of your jobs, I think, because we saw the place or something
checks.
Happened. Yeah, I think it was about whole paycheck. But when you were a whole paycheck, you were full-time for a while, weren't you? And then they changed it.
For 6 years, and then they found a way to get rid of people.
Yeah, Whole Foods is... a big joke. That was one of those.
And I used to joke around with people. One day, Mackey will sell out.
Yep.
And it might be Walmart or Amazon. I was just joking around.
You're right.
You're right. I hit the nail.
Well, let's go back to Marxism. The
so much for our conscious capitalism.
Yeah.
There, his little yellow book.
Yep.
I laughed when that came out. I was like, what?
Yeah. Well, Ben and Jerry's did the same thing. Then they sold out to a bigger corporation.
I tell you, I took one out and I was like tempted to put Das Kapital and like, here, read this.
Well, all the stuff that guy had to dance to, you know, Mr. Conscious Capitalism, he also had to pay bad wages, poor benefits, and increase the pressure on workers
destroy smaller businesses, all that's written
about in Capital by Marx and other works of Marxist economics and political economy that just say, hey, capitalism is all about the tendency, the concentration of production into monopolies, you know. And so now you have Amazon running the show, so to speak, biggest corporation, throwing its weight around. We're going to get to that later in the show, where Amazon in Seattle is trying its darndest with all its money and all its influence, including influence that they shouldn't have in the labor movement, part of the labor movement, to try and make sure that Shama Sawant, K-S-H-A-M-A, first name, Sawant, S-A-W-A-N-T, a member of Socialist Alternative who was elected as a socialist, open socialist, open member of Socialist Alternative, back in 2013 it was, maybe 14, and reelected since then once, and then is running for re-election again in Seattle for Seattle City Council. The only socialist on Seattle City Council, the only socialist I'm aware of on a big city council. I just found out today there's a couple socialists running for independently, not as part of the Democrats, as some people see. For me personally, the minute you call yourself a Democrat and run on a Democratic Party ballot line, you can't call yourself a socialist anymore. That just kicked you out of the socialist movement, maybe temporarily, maybe forever. It depends on what you decide to do later. If you do quit the Democratic Party and decide to run as an independent, as a progressive, that's better than being in the Democrats, and you can call yourself a socialist then. And if your policies fit somewhat, I'll go that far. I'll say you're a socialist, but I'm not going to lie and say anyone that runs as a Democrat, including Sanders, they're not a socialist. And Sanders just gave that speech not too long ago, where he defined again, it's the second time he's done this, defined democratic socialism. And he defined FDR.
What did he say? Capitalism with a conscience?
Essentially. Basically. Essentially, yeah. Yeah. Just like AOC. Ocasio-Cortez, another self-proclaimed socialist, defined, said that capitalism and socialism can coexist. No, they can't. Capitalism, because capitalism, you build up all the economic power you build up.
Can the wolf and the sheep coexist?
Right.
No, I don't think so.
All the economic power you build up translates into political power. Like you talk about Cuba a lot because you have connections to Cuba through your family. And right now, my understanding is that they're allowing more capitalist enterprise there. Yeah. That's going to, at some point, turn into a civil war because you can't... I'm not saying Cuba's socialist, but they have this sort of, you know... bureaucratically planned economy, sort of a Stalinist model, which we don't support, but it's there, and it's not capitalism, but they're allowing more capitalism. So at a certain point, you know, maybe someone started with a few private restaurants, or they got some money from the U.S. for a startup or something. Yeah. Next thing you know, they're expanding that, because that's how you make more money under capitalism. And then they're going to say, I want to expand it further. And this land, I don't own this land I need to own. My labor's not cheap enough to compete with Dominican Republic or something. So they're going to push politically. And the bureaucracy might give in to them, or it might take running new people, as either as part of the so-called Communist Party, like in China. You have capitalists calling themselves communists in China regularly now.
Yeah, I think that's the model they're more into. The
probably,
Chinese, The few 53 controlling, saying, okay, yes, you can open your shop,
yep,
but under our, direction.
But you could also have them running to be part of the Communist Party apparatus or trying to run independent and then clashing politically and maybe more than that with the ruling class there in Cuba. The Chinese Communist Party had its clashes as well as it was going from a bureaucratically planned economy to a capitalist economy.
Now they're having clashes with Hong Kong and...
Yeah, well, now, yeah, but I mean internally, but you're right, yeah. I mean, it's just, China's what I think you can call a state capitalist economy, and that it's truly capitalist. You got billionaires sitting on the so-called Chinese Communist Party board of directors or whatever they call themselves, Central Committee, whatever. They have billions of dollars, and they own factories and stuff. I mean, it's just ridiculous to call China communist in any way or socialist in any way. It's not. But they keep the nomenclature because within the context of Chinese history, which is pretty new. I mean, their revolution was in 1949. I mean, they were just outright capitalist, imperialist, victims of imperialism before that. That to a lot of people, the revolution was a huge step forward, and it actually did create the infrastructure that now the Chinese Communist Party is giving. You know that they're really capitalist, but they're giving it to international capitalism, including capitalists within China. They built up this infrastructure out of a very really backward economy, backward based on capitalism wasn't developing it. The imperialist, first colonization and then imperialism trying to control it. And then they get independence through the 1949 revolution. They go along a bureaucratic Stalinist line, kind of mimicking Russia. And they get to the point where they have actually developed the productive forces much more than capitalism did. But then they hand it over to capitalism to enrich themselves as the Communist Party leadership. And is that inevitable? No, it's not inevitable. It came about at a certain historic period where the only existing alternative to capitalism was the Stalinists in Russia and other smaller countries, and they had created a whole different thing from socialism, a whole different thing from communism, really. They created a bureaucratic dictatorship over the economy and society, and they developed the economy that way, and that had real problems with it, but not as bad as problems under capitalism. And we're not saying that's an alternative. It's not. But once there is an alternative, like if the early Russian Revolution had gone a different way and had kept its democratic Soviets or councils working, then there'll be a model that'll be different. And if people start following that model in different countries, we will have democratic socialism in the real sense, or democratic communism, whatever you want to call it. And you'll have people involved in voting, in terms of how they want to use their own labor, and how they want to use the resources that everybody should own and so on, collectively, all together in solidarity in terms of what people need, not what a few people will want from just to make huge profits, And that kind of society is not at all utopian the way it's labeled. That's society for our survival. We don't do that. How are you going to plan a world economy by a little bureaucracy or the capitalist dictatorships that exist? They're going to just run us into the ground like they are now with the world environment, global warming, climate change, and so on. They're not going to stop that because that would stop their profits. Exploiting nature is just as important to them as exploiting labor. Although, let me reverse that. They need to exploit labor even to exploit nature. So let's say labor's first if you want to make a hierarchy. Exploiting labor is what the whole system rests on. And in exploiting labor in a coercive, unfair way, obviously, even in the most advanced capitalist countries, economically or industrially, you still have basically work or starve is the operating motive, never get paid as much as the value you help create, and always expand to make more money for the rich bosses. So even in countries that are richer, quote unquote, social inequality is increasing. Even in those countries that someone like Sanders used to put up as an example of socialism, maybe he still does, the Scandinavian countries, inequality increasing, social problems increasing. You got Nazis coming up again in those countries, because they're feeding off of discontent. And the socialist movement is not big enough or it's sold out, the whole social democratic sellout of socialism, that they're not organizing people for better lives, or it's not obvious that they are to a lot of people. Anyway, back to the point about the U.S. economy. I mean, what do you think? Is it good times for all?
No.
For most?
No. Can't even, I mean, a good economy would be like affordability and housing.
Yep.
That's way beyond our reach.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
You know?
That would be affordability in education. Like, they're giving statistics now about college, where they say college attendance is falling. And they kind of like it, some of them. The capitalists don't think everyone should be educated that way. They think they can educate them in other ways, through the discipline of the workplace and work or starve and all that.
The
capitalists really don't like to train people up, so I don't know.
But they also like that debt over your, you know.
Oh, sure. Other ones love it. Other ones love it. The ones directly involved in education, now, you know, yeah. Like, but do they need everybody in that debt? They're making tons of money with only 53% or something like that ever attending college at all. Only about 25, last I read, only about 25% ever graduate. So less than half of those that attend, right. I think, graduate.
Then you get a certificate, right? Or yeah, whatever it is.
A degree or whatever.
And you go out there in the field, and it's you don't know nobody. Yeah. I've talked
to doctors.
It was like, no, I've talked to doctors. It's like, it was hard for me to get into this hospital. You know, even with my degree, my master's.
But then there's
or
a certain number of rich people that slide right into their.
Oh, I know.
Their their father's companies or whatever.
So at the end of the day, it's who you know.
Yeah.
You know, not what you know.
And inequality in the U.S. is increasing and tremendously during this so-called boom. They're calling it like this 10-year boom. Whenever that stuff happens, they trace it back to the Great Recession of 2007, 2008. They say since then it's been a boom. Whenever that happens, they start to lose it. It's really amazing because I've lived through this boom and bust cycle. Many times, and they start to question, gee, maybe there won't be another recession. Maybe the fundamentals of economics are different now, and the business cycle has disappeared, and now they're saying that. I haven't heard that lately, but I've heard this thing about it doesn't matter what the debt is. It doesn't matter what the debt is. And the Democrats just joined with the Republicans, and they did, I need to research this more, but they did a thing where they went through the debt limit to fund stuff, and
well, we're not backed.
The Pentagon, I guess.
The dollar's not backed up by actual gold.
No, not since 73 or something like that, yeah.
Oh, since 1913, I think. They took it off.
No, 70. It wasn't until that. Didn't come off the gold standard for real until, believe it or not, to Nixon, yeah. The Bretton Woods. Was it Bretton Woods, 73? I don't know. I have to check on that. But anyway, so we got the price of housing, which, by the way, here in Massachusetts, again, if you're a local listener, I just saw a thing today. It just went up to the average home price is 440. I'm not sure it's median or average. They didn't say, but it's 440,000. Who can afford 440,000? Even down payment on that, the mortgage rates, even though they're considered to be low now, they really aren't on the loans. That gets really, really ridiculous. Rents are high, really high. I don't have the latest figures on that, but they've been going up and up and up in all the major cities. And the places where you can afford rent, maybe. Although I've read statistics where there's no place in the country that you can afford a one-bedroom apartment on minimum wage. Nowhere. So that means even out in the middle of
they're saying
Arkansas.
Being homeless is against the law. So what am I?
Yeah.
So you're going to shoot me one day? You're just going to say, you know, you're homeless, sorry, bam, you know?
Well, you see big homeless camps, which they used to call Hoovervilles back in the Depression and, you know, in the 1930s. And now it's gotten so big, the homelessness problem in the United States, and so unfortunately normalized that there's things happening that don't make like the major news, you know. Like right now in Los Angeles, there's these homeless encampments, people using tents, for example, because the weather's a little better out there sometimes. It goes for miles. I saw a YouTube clip where someone just stuck their camera, you know, I think it was a phone probably, out their window and just drove. And thing goes on forever, man. It's just sick. It's just sick. And we know from Seattle, with the work that Shama Sawan and Social Alternative have done around fighting against homelessness, getting housing bill, getting money put to affordable housing and services for the homeless. And there's been some victories on that, which maybe we can go into later. We've talked about the show before. There's still problems in Seattle, with all the attention being paid and some gains being made. There's still huge homeless problems, and that's where they're doing a lot of this, like you just said, Diego, this
going around, it's against the law. Florida Keys,
right-wing groups are going around putting up signs and stuff against the homeless people.
Well, I think it was a place like a tourist place in the Key West where there's homelessness in the area of Florida, And you need to get. Oh, it was an RT today. That's what it was. You can't stay here. This is you're scaring away the tourists. You know, you need to leave. Shoot. I was the mayor. That was what it was. The mayor of Key West. Over by when Hemingway and his, you know.
Where I've never been there, but I think it's supposed to be something.
So now there's homelessness there, you know, and they're telling him, shoot, you're scaring away the tourists. Yeah. Get out of here.
And there's homelessness on the Cape. There's a bad opioid addiction, you know, on the Cape, I've heard, and other places. I see this thing, it's funny, on Facebook, Cape Cod Socialists. I don't know what you think of Cape Cod as, but Hyannis has working class people, and obviously people are doing the work out there. There was a member, I remember one time in the 90s, I went and visited a member of a Socialist Alternative who had a job as a carpenter out on Nantucket. And I got off the ferry and I thought I was in Disneyland. You know, everything is so clean and it's fake. It looks fake.
Yeah.
And so then when I found, the member of Socialist Alternative out there, he was living along with all the other workers, or a lot of the workers on the island, in a really cramped area where they had a big fence, right? So you wouldn't really see it too well. Big, all the houses all of a sudden, all the cottages crammed together. And he had like a, you know, not a very nice apartment. And he's doing his thing as a carpenter, trying to make money and save it. And everyone else there was doing the same thing, you know? But this was the 90s. It was a little harder to talk about socialism with his friends, but we tried. So that's a good metaphor for what we're talking about. We're talking about the reality of the economy. And if you just join us, we're Socialist Alternative Radio, talking music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And we are here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And today we're talking about, we're starting talking about their economy and ours, but then we're going to get into electoral politics 2019, we'll call it, and the ways out. And the ways forward, and they're not, might not be what you think. College costs up 500%. You know what gets me is the inflation. I mean, I've known this since I was younger, but I didn't know how they do it, and I still can't really do the math because I haven't researched it that deeply. But the whole way they calculate inflation is a mess. It's always been a mess. It's always excluded certain things, and it drives me crazy because the things I need, thinking about my kids going to college, that's up 500%. That's not factored into anything. Not my wage or anything like that. Or unfortunately, my union leadership not even thinking that way. The housing up, I don't know what percentage to put on it, but a huge percentage.
So your daughter and son can't go to Harvard even though you work for Harvard?
Ah, no, they can't.
So what happened to that little perk that they always like to get?
Harvard never had that, but Tufts had that for a while. I think they got rid of it. All that idea of all that noblesse oblige, as the French call it, all the rich people caring a little bit about the poor people, giving them little crumbs here and there, that's out the window now. It's just like, pure evil, basically. Capitalism is just running roughshod over people. And if you're one of the lucky, I mean, tiny, tiny, tiny few that managed to get scholarships and stuff now, that's nothing. Statistically, you might as well not even exist, you know? And I kind of feel sorry for you because most working class people in the United States are not hooked up to any kind of political understanding through mass movements, socialist movements. There's no socialist party here, no workers' party. So they go into a place like Harvard on a scholarship. They know something's wrong. they understand. I'm not saying they're stupid. They understand, like, they're not normal. And they have to still maybe work, or that people are living opulent lifestyles that they can't afford, and so on. And it's weird.
Like in the hospital, they call residents. You know, they're studying to become doctors or whatever.
Yep.
Not getting paid for it.
Right. I know. Isn't that insane? Yeah.
And they say, well, at least I'm getting a good experience. You're not getting paid for it.
Right. They really defend it? You should say, hey, lot of residents really are organizing into unions.
Well, then again, I have to think myself, how do you pay rent? In my head, I'm going, how do you pay rent?
How do you pay for medical school?
Rich daddy or rich mommy or something like that. It's got to be.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, I couldn't say, oh, yeah, it's fine. I'm not getting paid for it, but I'm learning a lot.
But the sad part of what both you and I are talking about in different examples is that...
And they're hand over fist making money off of sick people.
Right.
And not paying these people, you know, to anything.
Right. I know it's horrible. But what I was going to say was also, they sort of the person you were describing, they internalize capitalism. They internalize the values of capitalism. So a working class kid going to Harvard on a scholarship, which is very rare, instead of thinking about other working class kids and the whole system critically, most likely, and there are exceptions, but most likely they're going to internalize that, say, oh, I worked really hard and it's me and I'm a special person and blah blah. There's a lot of special people, you know. and they're gonna help the system. They're gonna be part of that replication of the ruling class, which is the reason higher education exists really in the United States. It really exists mainly to replicate the ruling class, especially the Ivy League schools. Other schools exist to train maybe lower elements of the ruling class, you know, professionals, quote unquote, like doctors, for example, to do what's necessary from the standpoint of the capitalist. But they always, you know, like, it's still really hard to get into medical school, for example. It shouldn't be. You could train up a million more doctors overnight if you had the will, if you had a planned economy, for example, a democratically planned economy. Say, hey, we need a lot more doctors.
It's one thing Cuba does for good. That's one thing Cuba does.
A poor country like Cuba can train up a zillion doctors because I don't want to get off on just medical care, but the things that they make seem so hard and so strange in medical care, and some of it is really hard, of course, but most of it isn't. Most of it they've deliberately obscured with Latin phraseology and over training and stuff, because they don't want to create, you know, it's an old kind of craft model. They want to create a shortage of doctors so they'll be worth more money rather than have a lot of doctors, which under capitalism would mean, which has happened anyway, kind of, you know, because the other side of the coin is the capitalists that own the hospitals and stuff, they create all these things like physician assistants and technicians and stuff to go around doctors doing a lot of work, and they're paid low, you know, and not the doctors necessarily, but the others.
Yeah.
So they do that, you know.
So there's one doctor. Yeah, I've seen that. I see the hierarchy of like the doctors that don't
used to be less.
Me. Don't bother me. I gotta get my tea. I gotta get my coffee time in here. You know, while everybody's doing his work.
But that's also deliberate. I mean, they might still feel elitist, like you're saying. But it's also work taken away from them, taken away from having more doctors. They're trying to, you know, dumb it down. And that sounds like what I'm talking about, but it's not at all. I'm talking about quality training to create more physicians, actually, not to dissemble, not to deconstruct the physician, not to deconstruct the position of doctor, to create more technicians and stuff. Because then you have all these separate people doing stuff, and they don't know the whole picture, and they need to. And you can't just have one doctor. I mean, they've got doctors, you probably read about this. They got surgeons doing two operations at once, maybe more for all I know, but at least two.
Yeah.
Completely insane. Only capitalism would think of that. That's just nuts. You know? That happens all the time.
Was it a heart or was it a liver? Oh my God, I forgot. What's what?
But anyway, we could come up with more examples, you know, about how.
And it's like, and I've seen this, like, we were talking about a couple of shows ago about how the nurses know more than some of these doctors.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Like, they're amazing. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yep. The nurses are basically the brunt of the whole, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've been at two where I was, you know, at with my wife. I don't want to sound like a spectator, but I was a little bit when we had our kids, right? I was right there in the room before, during, after. And when our kids were born, and the doctors, one of them was okay. The other one completely sucked. And the two other ones actually completely sucked. If it wasn't for the nurse, forget about it. You know, it would have been just a horrible experience. And the nurse, one nurse in particular, but other nurses as well, really saved us. You know, just made things go a lot better. And I think including with the health of the delivery, you know. Comparing notes with other people that have had kids, that's kind of true. The nurses really are the stars. And the doctors are kind of bad usually, not really that good. And I'm not necessarily blaming the doctors. It's the training. It's the conditions they're put under. Like you know, if you go to an HMO, right, they call them. I don't know what they call them now, but they're called HMOs, where they have these, you know, it's, in other words, I'm not going to a hospital for my medical care. I'm going to a office somewhere where they have a bunch of doctors, doctor's offices and stuff. And then nurses and stuff and some other things. But that's where a lot of people in the United States go, obviously. And I get in there and you find things out pretty quick, right? Like one doctor told me, and I knew this already from reading, but he's really encouraged to only spend 15 minutes per patient. Now, if it's a physical, they give them like an extra, you know, I don't know how much, but not that much. Because I had a physical recently. My doctor, you could tell, started looking at the watch. You know, as I'm bringing up more and more stuff because I'm getting older, she starts looking at her watch a little more, you know, wanting to get out of there, you know. And I don't, and you could see the pressure. And she was late to my appointment. And so they got the doctors like booked all day, 15 minutes a patient, blah, blah. That's crap, you know. You don't want doctors to be under that kind of stress. You don't want them back filling out paperwork.
I've been in a hospital, you know? Or should I say a centro de salud, meaning the center of the, kind of like a clinic.
Health center, yeah.
In Cuba. Yeah. You know, because you go to Cuba, you can get sick sometimes, you know. Yeah. It's different, mosquito bites, dengue, whatever.
Yep.
Right away, boom, boom, they get, and they're there with you, you know, talking to you.
Yep.
What do you feel? What, you know, how do you feel? This, that. Okay, I'm going to give you some, you know, I don't know how it is in France. Probably the same thing.
Well, I never went to the hospital in France, but if you look at that movie we talk about sometimes, Michael Moore's movie Sicko, he shows some of that, some of the difference between French healthcare and U.S. healthcare. It's a world of difference. My only connection with it was getting mildly sick in France when I was living there, going to the pharmacy, and it's a whole different experience when you're in the pharmacy there. They, at least it used to be, I think it probably still is.
Pharmacy there is like,
they're highly trained. They're almost like doctors.
It's like a clinic here.
Yeah, or, you know. Highly, highly trained, almost like doctors. Give you the drugs. I don't know if they took pity on me or whatever, but they gave me the drugs really cheap. And I'm out the door with good advice, and I got better, you know. And then I went back. I was one time just for a short time after I lived there, and the I had something small happened, and I went in, and same thing, you know. They were just knew their stuff really, really well. They were there to give you advice and think about your situation, and they said if you need any more help, you call this number, and a doctor will come see you. Nothing about money. Nothing about insurance. This will happen, you know.
Damn.
And that's also in Sicko. They talked about Michael Moore's film talks about people still.
They'll even do your laundry if you need it.
But see, it's interesting because I'm old enough to remember back in the '60s when I was a kid, into the '70s, and I don't know all the history of this, but we're going to get into this in a second a little bit. So everyone I know, and I grew up in a working class neighborhood, and I also knew people that different levels of poverty and stuff like that. But as far as I know, everyone had Blue Cross and Blue Shield as health insurance. But it was heavily, heavily regulated. So everything was much more affordable. And you had stuff like, yeah, doctors made house calls. Yeah, doctors were open all day on Saturday. I mean, I went to the doctor on Saturday. I never remember a weekday being at the doctor. Not once. And the same doctor. We had the same doctor all the time. This old Polish guy. To treat a lot of Polish people, because that's my mother's Polish, and was Polish, and we had no complaints, man. I mean, you had to go to the hospital, you went to the hospital. You were sick, this guy would be like, "Yeah, have him stay home for a couple weeks from school." Couple weeks, I'm not kidding. I never lasted that long because I'd be better in a few days usually, but it'd be like, "Yeah, have him stay home for a couple weeks." It was serious stuff. The medical care back then was pretty serious. Now they didn't get everything right. You know, they made mistakes.
It was better than today.
But it was better than now.
Sure.
A lot better than today. Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know when did it start sliding over? 80s,
in the 70s.
Late 70s, early 70s. 80s. HMOs appear for the first time.
It's in Sicko. He's the Nixon one who
did it. Yeah.
Yeah. He's the one that said, you know, we give him less care and more money. Oh,
yeah.
That was ludicrous.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Sir Charles Baker, the governor of Massachusetts, who every corporate media person calls him Charlie Baker to feed into the idea that this guy is like normal, and he's not. He's part of the ruling less than 1% elite made all his money off of exploiting sick people and hurting sick people.
Us three ran into him, me, you, and Seamus.
You have to tell that story every time.
I love that story because it's like the cameras are coming up. And like, Mr. Baker, Seamus goes, "What do you think? How do you think? What do you think about the minimum wage?
$15.
$15. This is back just to put a referendum question on the ballot."
Yep.
You know, and he's like, "Oh God, it's fine the way it is," and he just moves on. Like,
I think it's fine the way it is. And then afterwards, I'll never forget a couple guys who seemed—I think they were union guys—who were for some really rotten reasons were supporting him. They were nice guys, but they came up and said, "Yeah, we believe in that," you know. And I said, "Why are you supporting Baker?" And they said this and that.
Yeah,
and I said
that.
This and that. Remember that? Yeah, it was friendly discussion, but it was like, Man, and you know, I'm not there. We're not there saying support the Democrats. We're saying support this referendum.
Yeah, that's it. It was just a question on the ballot. Just, yeah, you know.
So Sir Charles Baker made all his money off of just what we're talking about, exploiting sick people through the actual HMO I go to, and he left behind a kind of a mess. You know, the infrastructure of the places I go to. It depends on where you are. Like I had to go to one in Wellesley, owned by the same company. It's owned by Atreus now. It used to be Harvard Vanguard. They, you know, just like whole paycheck, they sell up, they get taken over, monopolization. So I go to their Wellesley office, and it's really nice. But I normally go to like, you know, Somerville or what's the other one I go to? Kenmore, mm-hmm. And those are like caught stuck in time. The infrastructure, everything's like 80s. It screams at you, 80s, when you walk in and you walk around.
It's Arkham.
and they're not putting any money into those centers, you can see, even though they're crowded, even though they're busy. You know, Kenmore is very busy. So anyway, but speaking of all this stuff, their economy and ours, there's stuff that never gets talked about. We've talked about it on the show, but it's something that's talked about. Like, okay, so everyone knows how hard... Okay. In the United States... When there's a political upsurge in protest and so on, certain issues all of a sudden become discovered, you know? So I'm old enough to remember back in the 70s, daycare, childcare, we call it daycare here, but it should be childcare, was a big issue because there was a lot of agitation on women's issues stemming from the mass movement of the 60s and 70s. This carried on into the late 70s, early 80s, and other things receded. But I remember there's a lot of agitation around childcare. And some places you would get subsidized childcare, like for example, my brother and my sister-in-law, his wife, worked for the state of New York, and at the height of that struggle, they got subsidized childcare at their workplace in the state, literally pay like $5 or something. I mean, it was really cheap. And in other countries, of course, this is normal. Here, it only got put into being in certain places. Not even I'm talking about actual workplaces. Not even statewide anywhere.
The hospital. Yeah. If I had a kid, I'd probably get a little, you know, some kind of break.
I don't know. Maybe not. Don't count on that anymore.
I've seen that. I've seen women bring their children. Yeah. I'm like, oh, I'm working. I'm a secretary. And,
but it's less
bring their-
now than it used to be. And that's closest they'd ever got to something real as far as a big change was Head Start programs. And those come and go and those get cut and stuff like that. Head Start meaning you can send your kid to like a public school environment, but as a you know, pre-K, and it's and you have to qualify for that.
What happened to Boys and Girls Club? I remember those being around in the 80s when I was.
Well,
when I
that's
first
a good point. That's a good point. There are institutions,
and that's where I would hang out all the time, stay out of trouble.
There are after-school programs, and there are that's different from what I'm going to talk about. But yeah, that exists somewhat, but it's not government. You know, it's a private organization.
I really thought that was government. I really thought Boys and Girls Club was part of the so-called plan, what have you. Because I'm coming from a country where this is automatic, you know?
No, I know. Well, what I want to get into is even childcare has dropped away, although it's starting to come up again a little bit, I feel. Because people are suffering for it. We suffered for it. We blew a lot of our money and what little savings we had on childcare. And we're still doing that in a way, like summer camps and stuff. That stuff's really expensive, and we're still suffering for it. We're in debt because of that. Not only that, but that's a big factor. My family, I'm talking about. But and a lot of people are struggling with this. Unless you have family that's willing to come out of retirement, literally, you know, moms, grandmoms, grandfathers, uncles, whatever, take over childcare, and you're going to go out on the market. The wonderful capitalist market where you're paying like $2,000 a month for childcare. It's really, really expensive. And at these childcare places, they're private businesses mostly, you know. And that before, back in the 70s and 80s, into the 80s, was a big issue sort of. Like people were fighting, especially women's groups, were fighting for subsidized childcare. Like I already described, it didn't get very far, and that's receded. You know, one that I never hear about, and we've talked about on the show, is elder care. You have a situation now in the United States where you hear ads on the radio from lawyers. Now, you got to follow the logic here, which there isn't much, but you got to follow the logic here. Lawyers get on the air and say, you got to contact us if you think you're going to be in... what do they call it? There's a word for it, a phrase, something care.
Senior?
Sometimes senior care, but also, you know, yeah, if you're going to go, the equivalent of a nursing home, they usually don't use that phrase. If you're going to go into, if you're going to need some, you know, medical care as an elder, full-time meaning, and you're going to need all this stuff, you know, if you have to go to a nursing home, sometimes they do mention it, then you or someone you know has to go to a nursing home, your mom or dad or whatever, then you need to get in touch with us 5 years before that you think that's going to happen and work out a living will, a sort of trust, complicated legal thing where the nursing home can't take all your money. Now, why is that a danger? Because somewhere along the line, and I don't know where still, I've done some research on it, I haven't quite gotten to it, they deregulated elder care, nursing home care, to such an extent that, like, I remember when I was, even in the 80s, I remember this, cities would have their own nursing homes, you know? Like, it would be run by the city. Or you'd have a private one, but it'd be heavily regulated, and it would be cheap, relatively speaking. Now, even the cheapest, rottenest ones can charge you $14,000, $15,000 a month. Until you run out of money, until you prove you have absolutely no money left. Then, you can go on Medicare or something. But we're going to get into that in a second. And I'm not sure what it is for relatives. You know, if they have to blow through all their money or not. I don't think it is. I think it's just a person. So that's like the only regulation left, that once you impoverish the individual, everything's okay after that. Okay. But anyway, it's not okay. There's still a lot of expenses. And this would be true for visiting care or nursing home care. So I found this article interesting.
Yeah, it's like this place in Cambridge where you see, and there's an elder, you know, old, you know, like apartment.
Well, there's less of them now than there used to be.
And then it's not a week doesn't go by, there's not an ambulance and a fire department there picking somebody who just died. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And they probably didn't have to, by the way, but that's another story. I just want to get into this interesting article of something I think about a lot, called The Strange Political Silence on Elder Care, an article from Washington Monthly by Grace G-E-D-Y-E is the last name, Gedi. The Strange Political Silence on Elder Care, July, August 2019, Washington Monthly Magazine. Like, oh, somebody's going to talk about this for once. Really, it's just like not talked about. People are spending tens of, like for example, I have there's someone I work with who, they're not very political, so they don't think about how unjust this is, but their mother owned a house in a neighborhood where house prices are going up. So they sold the house, but everything they sold, practically, almost everything, maybe all of it, is going to go to nursing home care now. So they're finally putting her mother in a nursing home after struggling with taking care of her, but it's going to take up all the proceeds from that house, from selling that house, or most of it. I think it's all of it, but I'm not sure. So anyway, dipping into this article really quick, they say 34 million Americans provide unpaid care to an older adult. So that's one way people try to get around it. 34 million is a lot. Often a family member. But then it gets to the point where you can't even do that, right? It's too much. Most of these caregivers are middle-aged, and most are women. So you have middle-aged people taking care of middle-aged or older people. They are individually bearing most of the burden of one of America's most pressing societal challenges, how to care for a population of frail elders that is ballooning in size. Now, they're saying it's because the baby boomers are getting older. It's not just that. It would be a problem anyway, but that's a factor. Most people assume that Medicare will cover the type of long-term personal care older people often need. It does not. Neither does standard private health insurance. And the average Social Security check can only make a medium-sized dent in the cost of this care, which can easily exceed $100,000 a year if it's provided in a nursing home. Over $100,000 a year. Who's got $100,000 a year? The percentage of the population that makes $100,000 a year as an individual is completely tiny. The population of household income over $100,000 a year is also very small, but it you have to talk about gross or net income, you know, on that one. Medicaid, unlike Medicare, does cover long-term care, so it's Medicaid, but only for patients who have exhausted their savings. That's what I just was talking about. And coverage, which varies from state to state, can be extremely limited. So the safety net you thought would catch you in old age is less like a net and more like a staircase you get pushed down, bumping along until you've impoverished yourself enough to hit Medicaid at the bottom. The safety net you thought would catch you in old age... I'm sorry. I'm reading that again. Why am I reading that again? Is there a typo here? Yeah, it is a typo. Sorry. Private long-term care insurance exists, but it's the designer bikini of insurance. Too expensive, skimpy coverage. Since people tend to buy it only when they know they'll soon be making a claim, there are never enough healthy people paying into the plans to keep them affordable. So the implication there is we should pay for another health insurance plan after we're already paying for all these other ones. Insurance companies have realized this and jacked up premiums or stopped selling policies like that altogether. Meanwhile, the cost of hiring a home health care aide to take care of a frail patient can add up to $50,000 or more per year. So tens of millions of individual women across the United States wind up providing health care, the care of themselves for free, and bearing its cost in the form of stress, lost wages, lost opportunities to nourish their other needs, and their families' needs. When we talked on the phone, this woman that is doing this, taking care of an elderly relative, why is it that we don't have a good system that we can plug into when our parents need care? Why indeed? You might expect that a problem that affects so many people will become a major political issue. But in recent years have seen other issues, including ones that disproportionately affect women in their personal lives, become highly politically salient, meaning important, from sexual harassment to pay equity to the push for universal pre-K and improved access to child care, although that one I would say isn't really that being pushed enough. Yet even though American women today are politically organized and running for office in record numbers, elder care remains widely viewed as a purely personal matter. You could be a news junkie following the 2020 race closely and have heard nothing about it. And that includes me, by the way. I've heard nothing about it. Now, let me see if they, I skimmed through this before. A driving factor... approximately half of us will need some form of long-term care, 50%, and an estimated 15% will face related medical bills exceeding $250,000. And let's see. Anyway, I think that's the main thing I wanted to make the point. This is like this crisis. It was easy to see coming, they say, as far back as 71. Congress held hearings on the impending crisis in long-term care, and throughout the 80s and 90s, think tanks and Blue Ribbon Commission issued a stream of reports on what to do about it, predicting catastrophic consequences by the 2020s if the problem went unaddressed, but it did go unaddressed, perhaps like climate change. It was both unpleasant to contemplate and seemed far off. Other countries with aging populations, including Japan, Canada, most European nations, took action. They offer a range of substantial benefits to family care providers, from direct compensating their work to subsidized professional home care. But in the United States, public attention to long-term care faded even as the problem grew increasingly acute. So they're saying some of the things that I've been talking about, thinking about. But what they don't say is when did they deregulate nursing homes and stuff to make this possible? Because they weren't always able to charge you $15,000 a month. But they don't get into that really. As far as I can see. So anyway, another example of their economy and ours. This is not working for us. And this is an expense that many, many people have to deal with. Otherwise, what do? You send your mom. I mean, I ran into this with my father. Anyway, another example, the other end of the spectrum, from older to younger. Many college students are too poor to eat, from The Atlantic. You know, no one agrees on just how many, and now lawmakers are interested in being able to change that. Well, we'll see about that. But anyway, this has actually come about in a couple ways I've seen. On Facebook, there are more and more stories about high school kids who have to pay for lunch in their schools, or junior high or elementary school. I'm talking about college students in a minute. And they can't afford to pay. They're given like a smaller lunch, and they're kind of, in some cases, named and shamed. And one school system went so far as to send a thing home threatening that the state would come and take your children away unless you paid your lunch bill. This was a scandal. This got out. They retracted it, etc. But why aren't all school lunches free? I mean, they should be. I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous. You know, and where they are free in some schools, very few, but in some, the kids really, really rely on those lunches. In fact, in Boston, they had a thing where for kids that qualified, and again, the qualifications are too rigid, but kids that did qualify for free school lunch in the summertime, they tried to continue that program somewhat. I don't know how it's worked, of providing free lunch for some kids. And there was even this one day on the, I think in Boston City Hall or something, where they gave free lunch to everybody. I think it was the first day of summer or something like that. They say under capitalism, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Well, there could, they're right in a way. There can't be under capitalism, but under socialism, there easily could be. There's enough food to go around. There really is. There's enough labor to go around to make the food necessary. But here we have a situation where in college, with the high cost of colleges, we talked about earlier in the show, going up like, I've heard figures 500% in the last decade. And, you know, colleges costing, you know, not just Ivy League, but others costing, you know, $50,000 a year, $75,000, $100,000 a year when you get up to the really expensive schools. This is just insane. And at the same time, stuff that existed in the 70s, like outright grants called Pell Grants and others, have been cut drastically. Loans have been brought in with high interest rates, loans that you can't escape, that if you try to declare bankruptcy, they'll still come after you for your student loans. They'll take your wages away and stuff. Anyway, this is actually from the federal government, a report about the breadth of food insecurity on America's college campuses. Growing body of research saying that college students are routinely going hungry. But the authors claim, and this is Tom Merton from the, or Adam Harris from the Atlantic, sorry, that neither the government or the studies that are coming out are consistent in describing the scale of the problem of college students too poor to eat. So whatever the exact numbers that are out there, and there are possibly millions of students who don't have enough to eat, college students. One recent survey from Temple, for example, found that 50% of students at more than 100 schools could not afford to eat a balanced meal, and 35% were skipping meals entirely because they did not have enough money for food. Nationally, about 13% of Americans are food insecure, but some surveys have estimated that the percent of college students in the same situation is roughly three times that. This population is particularly vulnerable to going hungry, as many are spending all available funds on costs associated with school, like, you know, tuition, room and board, rent, if they can't get room and board, rent, can't afford room and board, books, etc., transportation, and holding down a full-time job, let alone a lucrative one, can be extremely difficult. So trying to deal with this and holding down a full-time job. So they give some stories here about this, they think the problem is getting worse. Students, most of them don't get any kind of SNAP benefits, more commonly known as food stamps. And, quote, students cannot solely rely on the generosity of food banks to keep on course to succeed. We need to prioritize and address the systemic barriers in the way of an equitable path to a college degree. So imagine you're trying to get your degree and you can't afford food. Now, for me, that was not a concern because I did the room and board thing, which was extremely expensive. I ended up paying for that later. But if you miss a meal or something, and that had to happen sometimes, then you... I had to tough it out like a lot of other people. And you know, I use the word tough it out as like, oh, well, that was a good thing for my character building or something. No, it wasn't. I was really short on money a lot in college, and it drove me crazy. And the place now, as I'm much older or back in college, to cut when you're short of money is one of the places you can actually cut, or you think you can, is food. That's why people are skipping meals. That's why there's this thing called food insecurity, because you find out under a budget, under the pressure of bills you have to pay, or you feel you have to pay, or else really horrible, catastrophic things will happen, that you will, you'll just skip meals, you'll eat rotten or food, and then of course that catches up to you with health problems and stuff, and then fast food and so on that you try to supplement, more expensive food for, more healthier food for, not only has the health problems, but it's really, and it really starts to add up. So anyway, let's see. Then it goes into what the government's doing. Not much, really. They want some sort of bill, but it's just, there's disagreement on it. Food insecurity is a college completion issue, meaning that it causes students to drop out. And that gets into, like, why are you giving financial aid with one hand and then the other hand not paying enough for people to really survive? There's a lot of people, like we talked about earlier in the show, drop out of college in the United States. I would have to double check this, but with other, compared to other countries, the U.S. has a higher percentage going to actual college, but the U.S. Has a lower percentage of people finishing school, finishing college, and getting a degree. So, you know, we could have added a million other examples about their economy and ours, and what's really working, and what isn't, and who's really working and who isn't. But a lot of people are following statistics, as I try to, and as others try to, that are socialists, about, well, where's the economy headed? And there are some signals, besides what we've talked about already, like with things like, cars are really expensive now. We could have talked about cars being more expensive. Public transit stinks in the United States. So people are getting really horribly in debt with cars than they used to. Like, even used cars are very expensive now. So people are taking on increased car debt than they used to. And even as cars are getting more expensive, and then that's one reason why, of course. And the percentage rates on car loans is increasing. They used to be considered a loan traditionally with lower rates. That's increasing. So now you have this car debt. And then you have, of course, as a result of that, more people not paying, like a big jump in people not paying their car loans. So even the capitalist economists are kind of like, oh, well, wait a minute. If they're not paying their car loans back, does that mean that there's a economic crisis looming? You know, then you have the other accounts we talked about earlier, that whenever a so-called upswing or boom happens that goes over a certain number of years, they're ready to say, oh yeah, capitalism has solved its problems. Everything's fine. But inequality is just out of control in this country. Anyway, we're going to take a quick musical break. You're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio. Your hosts today are Jeff and Diego, and we are here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. With talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And let's give the old legal ID here. We're WMFO Medford. That's the station you're listening to, WMFO in Medford. But we describe ourselves as 91.5 FM, WMFO, Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio, also known as Tufts Educational Radio. And thanks for listening, and we'll be right back.
A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon. You know, the man just upped my rent last night, 'cause Whitey's on the moon. No hot water, no toilets, no lights, but Whitey's on the moon. I wonder why he's upping me, 'cause Whitey's on the moon. Well, I was already giving him 50 a week, and now Whitey's on the moon. Taxes taking my whole damn check. The junkies make me a nervous wreck. The price of food is going up. And as if all that crap wasn't enough, a rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. Was all that money I made last year for Whitey on the moon? How come I ain't got no money here? Whitey's on the moon. You know, I just about had my fill of Whitey on the moon. I think I'll send these doctor bills, air mail special. To Whitey on the moon.
Standing on the corner, spending my time, not of a job, not earning a dime. Lady steps up, says, I suppose you're a stylish young man by the looks of your clothes. She says, just me, and take a little tip.